Good Morning Comrade, goodmorningcomrade.com. You can listen to us also on Tuesdays on WHIV FM on WHIV FM at 8 o'clock in the morning. You could also check us out online, WHIVFM.org/listen, goodmorningcomrade.com. Today we have a special guest, Jen Briney. She is the host of the Congressional Dis podcast. She is a person who chose willingly as her kind of job. Yeah, it's your job.
It's my job.
It's your job to read the bills that go through Congress and sort of analyze and communicate them, which nobody in the world actually does that. People in Congress don't read the bills that go through Congress. And I guess I've been listening to that show for a very long time, probably about at least since 2012, 2013. And it's really good to have, this is the first time we're talking in person, so it's really good to have you on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And yeah, you've been one of the first supporters of my show, like way back in the day. Yeah. So, yeah, thanks for helping me continue to do this.
Of course, of course. Anyway, I just kind of wanted to, kind of talk about what's going on with the COVID response. You just put out two different episodes, probably about four total hours on the subject of coronavirus. If there's a way that we can sort of sum some of that up, would you be able to kind of talk about what's been going on since, especially the government response to it?
Sure. Well, the two episodes I've put out so far, the first one was just, I was looking at the hearings with the health professionals because there was a lot of panic when this first started. So I did an episode which is like, this is what the health professionals are telling Congress, the end. But the second one, I read the first two COVID response bills that they passed into law. And so the first one essentially funded vaccines. I mean, that's the big thing in that law. And that's all fine and good, actually, because we need a vaccine. But the thing that made me really mad about it is that they didn't put any price protections in there for us. And so our tax money is going to go to develop these things. And then we get to pay for it with unlimited profit potential for the drug companies when this is all over. So I kind of likened it to ordering a pizza. Like, you pay with a credit card over the phone for them to develop you a pizza.
Right.
And then they come to your door and refuse to give you the pizza unless you pay them in cash. Yeah, it's basically the deal we've set up with vaccines.
You pay for it on the front end, just to say, you pay for it to sort of like come up with how you're going to make the pizza, to like do the recipe or whatever, or the trial and error and whatever the costs are going to be. And then you pay for the pizza again when you buy it. So so essentially our tax money is funding pharmaceutical companies, medical companies, companies that make vaccines and tests. Not just for this one seems to be specifically focused on vaccines, but essentially we're paying them to develop these mechanisms or these products, I guess you could say, from their perspective. And then after they get the money to develop them, then they get the opportunity to sell them also for a profit. So they're not risking anything to develop these sorts of things. The risk's on us, and they also get to just make in, cash money when it's time to, sell it.
Yeah, and it's like, I'm not even all that offended by the idea that they get to sell it on the other end, but that they get to develop, or they get to determine the price.
Right.
That's the part that pisses me off, because we've already seen that, like, insulin is a really good example. This was something that was developed in 1922, and yet because these companies have a patent, they're charging people so much that people are not able to get their insulin. So they've already proven that these companies are going to charge as much as they can possibly get away with for life-saving medicines. And so they can't be trusted. And Congress was in the position to say, here, we're going to give you some tax money and you can make reasonable profits, but they left it unlimited because our Congress is owned by these giant companies, really.
Right. And that's a really kind of a point that we talk about on this show a lot, is that, again, this is a thing that can be addressed in sort of change, but the way things currently are, the people that are currently represent us in our government, well, you know, they are they're sponsored by they're sponsored by essentially multi-million dollar companies that fund their campaigns when they run for the office that they end up holding, right? So if you become a senator,
it's not just the campaigns. Mm-hmm. The bigger problem, the way I see it, is that the industry is allowed to actually write these provisions.
Yeah.
So what they do is they look to the lobbyists as the experts.
Right.
And so that's how these provisions get written, especially when we have bills that are written this quickly with very little help. Or because we blame all of Congress, but really for these laws in particular, and for a lot of them, they're written behind closed doors. They're supposed mm-hmm. to be written in committees with help from experts, with, you know, everyone on the committee being involved in the crafting process. And that's not happening, especially with these laws, because Congress is literally on vacation. And so they're being written by Nancy Pelosi, Mitch McConnell, Chuck Schumer, Kevin McCarthy to a lesser extent, but it's being written by a handful of people behind closed doors. Steven Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, he's not even in Congress and he's writing these damn things. And they are getting these provisions from the lobbyists they know in the industry.
Right.
And not really reading them, because I can tell you right now, I'm working on the third law. So a little bit after your episode comes out, I'll be releasing my 213th episode, which is about that big stimulus law mm-hmm. that appropriated trillions of our dollars. Well, that one didn't get a vote in either the Senate or the House, really. They just passed it through because they did in the Senate, but it passed 96-0 and they didn't have time to read it, because I'm reading this. I've been reading it the entire week. I'll be reading it all of next week for about 6 hours a day. And they voted on it in the Senate with less than an hour mm-hmm. between the time that the text was released and they voted on it. And then the House is already on vacation. So they didn't vote at all, and they sure as hell didn't read it.
How did they get it through?
So in the House, they did something called a voice vote.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Quite sketchy. But basically what they wanted to do was even sketchier, which is called unanimous consent, where mm-hmm. basically someone can get up and say, I want to pass this bill. And if no one objects, then the bill passes. There was one person, Representative Tom Massey of Kentucky, who said, wait, no, we're passing something that's, 880 pages and appropriates trillions of dollars. This is not how it should be done. So he said, I'm going to object. So what they did instead was something called a voice vote, where some people did have to come back to the House of Representatives, not nearly all of them. And all they had to do when he stood up and said, I object to this, they said, okay, we're going to do this voice vote. And essentially, because no one stood with Tom Massey and seconded his objections, it was able to pass without a recorded vote in the House.
Oh, because he needed a second or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So basically the people that were in that room, Democrats and Republicans together, conspired against Tom Massey to prohibit a vote being taken in the House of Representatives on this massive bill. And the PDF that I have to give people an idea of how long this is, I got one that has normal margins and normal font. So it's 335 pages. And I finished the first 100 pages. And just in those first 100 pages, I have found scandals that are worth entire episodes.
Yeah. And this is not breezy reading either. This is very dense, sort of policy based. We're going to do this. This money's going to come from there. And we're going to, this department's going to oversee it. Or if there is oversight at all. There's a lot of very sort of dense legal language that's involved in these sorts of things. And they're not supposed to, I guess. They're that way for a very specific reason, but the fact that these bills are written in such detail in such a quick amount of time means that this text has to exist somewhere already, and it's sort of being sewn together when this emergency pops up, right?
A lot of these ideas are ones that have been pushed for a while by the different lobbyists or industries, and so that's how they get in, because there's one provision in here that really only benefits people that make over $250,000 a year. So and it has nothing to do with COVID-19, and it's worth $170 billion. This is something that just does not belong in this bill.
Right.
And it's one of those things where that had to be sitting around somewhere. There are some rich people that have been pushing for this, and it got slipped in. And the thing was, I saw the provision yesterday, and it was one of those like some of these, if they're adding new law, are written in normal English and you can understand them quite quickly what's going on. There's other ones though where they're editing something that's in current law. So you have to go back and forth between the current law to see what it is and then figure out what the changes were.
Yeah.
And that provision is so, it took me 6 hours to get through two provisions yesterday because I had to go back and forth and figure out, am I really seeing what I'm seeing here? And it was tax law. And, mm-hmm. and so it's stuff like that. Like if you were to try to just go through the table of contents and try and find all of those things mm-hmm. with the way that provision is labeled, you never would have zeroed in on that. And you, there's no chance you would figure out what that was just by looking at mm-hmm. it. You had to take the time to dig through it. And like I said, it took me 6 hours and I've been right. doing this now for almost 8 years. I'm pretty good at it.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I tore into it that I was like, uh-oh, this is a thing.
Yeah. And you feel like you're talking about like, oh, reference to this and that and the other thing. It's almost like I have this image in my head of like, you remember that meme of Charlie from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia? And he's got like a whole bunch of things on the wall and the string going from like one to the other. That's sort of like the image that I get. Like, you have to go to reference this previous law, which references something else. And you sort of like have to make these connections and sort of like sew that together. You're sure to even understand what's going on when they write these things or when you're reading these things. And so
I have multiple internet browsers up all the time because I'm going back and forth between the bill I'm reading and the law I need. And then, like you said, sometimes that law edits another law.
Yeah.
That's really what it is. I have to be really in the zone to read this too. So that's the other thing. A congressman right before a vote, when they only get an hour on a bill this long, they just don't have that opportunity.
Yeah.
So even though there are people in our Congress, like we like to paint them all with one brush, there are definitely people that are offended by this process and think it's wrong and are doing the best they can. But they are at such a disadvantage because of the way the laws are structured. Like there's just no way to fully grasp them, no matter how many of these you've seen.
Do you think that another part of this issue is this sort of reflexive sort of either trust or discipline or whatever that rank and file sort of like members of Congress and sort of like as a second and third order thing, members of like people who are around it and people that are in the press and people that are a part of sort of, you know, Democratic organizations or, you know, either on either side or whatever, they are sort of responsive and trusting at least, or at least they're able to be convinced to follow the lead of leadership. And there's not a whole lot of kind of, there's no real critique that can take place in all but just a very few, I guess, amount of circumstances. There's like an apparatus to sort of like maintain the discipline of regular rank and file members.
See, I'm not really sure. I've definitely heard people that are angry about the process and speak out about it.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that the leadership controls who's on what committee.
Yeah.
And so you really do have to play the game in order to have any power in any way when the committees aren't completely skipped to begin with. But like people like Tom Massey, he's serving his constituents and people that aren't in Kentucky like me. He's serving us well when
right.
he does stuff like say like, no, we need to vote on this. But both parties wanted to stay on vacation. And so they're all really pissed off at him. He's not going to get to be on any committees. He's not going to be in the room when anything is written. So it's kind of like, do you play the game and get to have your voice be in the room when these things are written? Or do you not play the game, maybe keep your seat, but really be ineffective as a congressman? So they have to kind of make that judgment.
Yeah.
And I get it because there are some very, very good people that I want in the room,
mm-hmm.
you know? So it's like AOC. She's the best example. She's the most famous. Everyone knows who she is. People are getting really pissed off at her right now because she didn't stand with Tom Massey. But at the same time, there's only so many times she can piss off Nancy Pelosi before her ass is off of every committee that she's on.
Right.
So it's they're making calculations that make a lot of sense to me. I think the bigger problem is that there are so many people in Congress that have been there for literally my entire life, for mm-hmm. 30, 40, even 50 years at this point. And so they have convinced themselves that this is just the way it is, that this is how Washington operates. This is how it will always operate. And it's okay. And anyone who says it isn't just doesn't understand. those people need to be fired, and the culture in Washington needs to change, because once you watch Congress closely, you see that some of these people that are supposedly like enemies in politics, Democrats and Republicans, sometimes they're roommates. Sometimes they're best friends. Literally, like sometimes they're best friends. They go to these cocktail parties on Friday at noon and they're all in there together hobnobbing and all of these fancy parties. And I think one of the things that really helped us peasants see this is the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Mm-hmm. Where even the media, they all want to be friends. They all want to be in this club.
Yeah.
And so that's why the way I cover this, by tearing apart these laws and pointing out, like, you know, one of the provisions that I was reading while waiting for this interview to happen, I'm reading one where they appropriate $23 million to healthcare, you know, educational grants, mm-hmm. which is a significant cut for most of them. Yeah. While at the same time, they provided $170 billion for the richest people in this country for no reason whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And it's like, that's the type of stuff that happens when the rich people are in your social circle,
right.
And the, you know, the students that are in med school are not. And so I think we just have this entire culture of, we've allowed the elites, for lack of a better term, to really run Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And until we do something about that, until it stops being this club of rich people that think that this behavior is normal and okay, until we replace them mm-hmm. in the halls of power with people like us, I don't think much is going to change. We have to have more bartenders like AOC,
right.
and less people like Nancy Pelosi, who have been in Congress for 40 years.
Right. Definitely less of the people who have been in Congress for 40. And it's not like a generational thing. It's just a part, just kind of absorbing into that kind of like culture of power that exists, you know, that sort of like very, I mean, it to me, at least from the outside, looks very sort of hierarchical in the sense that the leadership, and I'm not like making a comment on whether or not hierarchy is a good thing or a bad thing. I'm just saying this is what I see, is just people from the top of the organization just sort of saying, this is what we want to do. In whose name are they acting? They're acting in the name of the millionaires and billionaires, but essentially they are able to get what they want just by the virtue of they're in the position to push the agenda and use those sort of carrots and sticks that you mentioned earlier to get that discipline, at least to the point where it's any kind of resistance or rebellion is mitigatable.
Pretty much.
I guess sort of like what the question becomes in a sense is, how can that be contested? Not just when elections come up, even though they are important and there's a lot of people, especially on the left, that it would disagree with that, but there is a direct impact for how these things play out, and there's a direct impact on like how people engage with these sorts of things, and if you like how you are engaged with that process shows how much essentially sway and power you have in that theater. So for example, if you're going to like support a congressman or whatever, or somebody who's challenging to run for Congress, then you have the opportunity to essentially support and pressure that person when they get in there, that they might be able to act against leadership because they're pressured by their constituency.
Yeah, I mean, that's all you can do. We only have each of us. I mean, it seems so overwhelming when we look at all of Congress because there's 535 of them, but
right.
each one of us only has sway over two senators and one member of the House.
Right.
And if we all just took responsibility for those three, mm-hmm. we'd be in a better place.
Right.
But I think one of our bigger problems is when we talk about elections, all of the focus is on the presidential level.
Yeah.
And it needs to be on the congressional level. And mm-hmm. I think that's what, like, I'm sitting here, I live on an island between Oakland and San Francisco that most people don't even know exists. And so I look across the bay all the time at San Francisco, which is Nancy Pelosi's district. And we're supposedly supposed to be some of the most woke people in the country. And yet they have the power to fire this woman who I think has deserved to be fired for a long, long time. And I get that she's better than like John Boehner and Paul Ryan. I get that.
That's a low bar to clear.
Exactly. It's like, just because she's better than the absolute worst, the way that she's run the House of Representatives, especially right now, the fact that her district isn't up in arms being like, get our Congress back to D.C., woman, like, we need them voting. You're not supposed to be writing the bills with Mitch McConnell
right.
in closed doors. Like, this isn't how it's supposed to happen. Her district is just not paying attention. It's all Trump, Biden at this point. And I think that's a major problem, that there's so many people that don't even know who their representative is in the House. A lot of us know our senators, mm-hmm. but we don't pay any attention to the House. And that's where most of our individual power is. That's why I started this show, focusing mm-hmm. really on the House even more than the Senate, because I wanted to know, because I didn't know what's going on there. This mm-hmm. is the branch that's supposed to represent me most directly, and I don't even know what they do. And obviously, after 8 years, I'm horrified once I found out.
Right. A little bit of reading. And
well, and it's easier, too, for people that are journalists, especially on television. They're just regurgitating what other people are reporting. Like, I'm, like you said, I'm one of the very few people in this country. There are some excellent journalists that I depend on to help me with my job. I don't want to say I'm the only one, because that's completely not true. But for sure. the most part, if you turn on the television, you're not going to hear the details of the stimulus law. Mm-hmm. It passed on March 27th. We're talking on April 10th. It's already old news. No one's looking into it, even though I'm still not all the way through it, because it's really hard to do. Mm-hmm. And so, and I don't know how we fix that. Mm-hmm. I don't know how we fix that unless we demand our journalists to cover this more, and unless we take responsibilities ourselves for the House of Representatives. I don't know how we fix this, mm-hmm. because it's not going to be fixed on the presidential level. It has to be Congress.
Yeah. And one of the things that I also think about is places like I live. So I live right outside of New Orleans in a place called Jefferson Parish, and it's Steve Scalise country. And yes. I remember that last election that took place, and there were a couple of people who put together sort of like a, you know, try hard campaigns to try and take him down or whatever. But that was like right in the middle of, right after, I suppose, he had gotten, like, he had survived the gunshot.
Yeah. You know,
and he was essentially running on, like, he's like a Steve Strong sort of, like,
I got shot for America.
Yeah. I survived gunshots because, you know, some crazy lib Bernie Sanders supporter decided to put a couple in my hips, you know?
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, that does seem extremely hopeless and demoralizing. Not that there shouldn't be something to, you know, you need to organize around these sorts of things and fight towards them. It's just a really sort of daunting task, you know?
It isn't. I mean, if you pick the right person, like my mother's district, the district I grew up in, mm-hmm. is in Orange County, California, which is, it's a bunch of people that are not rich, but think that they're going to be any day now. And so they always vote Republican.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was Republican my entire life. But then Katie Porter was mm-hmm. an excellent candidate. She's wonderful. She's one of the people, she got up in the hearing. I don't know if you remember this from my episode, but she challenged the CDC director with some brilliant questioning. She took mm-hmm. her 5 minutes and she got us free testing for COVID-19.
Yeah. And oh, yeah. I remember that. Yeah.
She's phenomenal. And she has really taken on the banks. Every time she gets up to question anyone in a hearing, I stop what I'm doing and I listen to every word. She's really effective. She's a great congresswoman. And I never would have thought that was possible in my mother's district. Mm-hmm. I had just like given up on it completely. But once you have someone that can articulate what they're trying to do and talk to people, no matter which side of the aisle they're on, districts like that can swing to a good representative regardless of party. And so that's given me a lot of hope. The fact that AOC, a bartender, took down one of the highest members of the DNC.
Yeah, in New York, where voter suppression is the order of forever since the entire history of like Tammany Hall, you know?
Exactly. But that's the thing about voter suppression. They look at like all of the polls, all of it is based on people who have voted before.
Yeah.
And so that's why Bernie Sanders' strategy, which unfortunately didn't work because our generation and the youngers are not showing up the way we need them to. Mm-hmm. But you can take all of their calculations and throw them out the window with new voters, mm-hmm. because everything they do is based on who's voted before.
Right.
And so one of the saddest things is that the people under the age of 40 in this country really haven't voted in the numbers that we represent. I mean, young people in this country, we now outnumber the boomers. We could really change this Congress right now, even if the elders don't want us to. We have that power. We're not using it. But that also means there's an enormous untapped potential mm-hmm. for the minute that we want to use it. So I'm really holding on to that hope that something will happen. Maybe it's COVID-19 to wake people up and they'll be like, oh, we have a big problem with our Congress. Like, this needs to be fixed. Mm-hmm. So even if they don't like Trump or Biden, I'm just hoping that our Congress being literally on vacation, both sides, like the Republicans control the Senate, the Democrats control the House, they all went on vacation. Yeah. I'm hoping that's enough to make people in November go like, yeah, maybe we do pay more attention to Congress this year.
Yeah, dipping is bipartisan.
Oh my God. I cannot get over my anger about it. And yeah, I don't even get me started on this vacation. I can't even deal.
Yeah,
unless you want me to, I'm happy to scream about it.
I'm not going to stop you. Go ahead and scream about it. I mean, like the way that it also sort of played out was that there, like, this was a part of the sort of brinksmanship strategy that both of these parties, you know, or like Mitch McConnell and Nancy Pelosi were playing with each other. Okay, that's what we're passing. We're out of here.
Yeah, there's a strategy behind it, but it doesn't make it okay, because now what we're seeing happen is they want to pass a fourth COVID response bill, but the Constitution says they have to vote in person. So even though, I mean, you and I are talking from 2,000 miles away over Zoom, like, there is a way to pull this off technologically. Is it constitutional? And if they don't vote in person, like, are they going to, like, will lawsuits be able to overturn those laws? Like, what would happen in that case? And so Nancy Pelosi is saying, well, we have to vote by voice vote. We can't have an actual vote because it's too dangerous to bring everybody back here. Mm-hmm. And so just let me write the laws and then pass it by voice vote. And it's like, you never should have let them leave D.C.
Yeah.
Every single one of them had a place to live. You could have gone on recess in D.C. so that they're all there if they need to do their jobs. But they didn't do that. She let them all go home and scatter all over the country. Now we have 6 members of the House of Representatives and at least 1 in the Senate that have COVID-19.
Right.
Let's also keep in mind that they're all elderly, or not all of them, but damn near most of them are elderly. It's exactly the people that need to be staying home right now. And so they can't be getting on planes and trains and maybe automobiles, which means that the East Coast will be represented pretty well, and the West Coast and Hawaii and Alaska just screw all of us.
Yeah.
It was a terrible decision. What really pisses me off about the House in particular is the first time they went on vacation was March 14th, which we were locked down here in San Francisco 2 days later. So it's like the signs were there, but fine. You can forgive that one. But then when they had to vote on the trillions bill, 200 of them came back to Washington, D.C., and they went on vacation again on March 27th. And it's unconscionable. And it seems to me like the brinksmanship strategy is a big part of it, because that allows the leadership to vote without the members of Congress for their own safety.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just getting grosser and grosser to me what's happening with Mitch McConnell and Nancy Pelosi, because the buck stops with them when it comes to congressional leadership.
Mm-hmm.
They want to write these bills. They don't want the committeed process. They don't want the sunlight on what they're doing until after it's done. And this is the strategy. Send them all home. Oh, it's a health emergency.
Yeah.
They can't come back. And that way Pelosi and McConnell get to do whatever they want.
It's a way to consolidate power, isn't it? That's essentially what it is. I mean, actually, I am so important. I need to take care of this situation. It's an emergency. I'm here to show leadership. Y'all all go play with your toys at home. You know, that's the sort of thing. And it's similar to what, I mean, again, you can almost see the oligarchy, which already does exist, but it's sort of like coming even further. It's further articulating in the sense that there's this heightened amount of power on fewer and fewer individuals. You see what I'm saying? And that's, I mean, whether it's stated in law or whatever, there's precedent, and that's the way things are going, and status quos have power. And that's something that we have to sort of like break through, regardless of who these people are.
And this behavior right now is setting a really dangerous precedent. And we can't let everybody that went home off the hook either. Mm-hmm. There is individual responsibility. And so any representative from California that didn't see that maybe they would be needed in DC and decided to go home to spend quarantine with their kids and their puppies, they definitely deserve a lot of blame too, because some of them didn't do that. Yeah. Tom Massey is still in Washington, DC. I'm pretty sure AOC is too. Some of them said, no, I'm going to stick around here because things are going to go down. And those people deserve to keep their jobs. But anyone who's dialing in, like, I like to go on Twitter and just see who is doing their at home, you know, like town halls from their bedrooms. I like to watch them just long enough to see if they say if they're in their district or if they're in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And if there's a couple that are in D.C., most of them went home. And I think shame on every single one of them, because everything that's happening right now is completely predictable.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And it's predictable. Again, there's a whole lot of what went down that was extremely predictable. In fact, to the point where you can predict it if you're a senator named, oh, what was his name? The guy who sold all the stocks, him and Loeffler.
Roy Blunt.
It was Blunt? Was that who it was? That,
oh, no. It was Burr. Burr.
Richard. And so there was, in terms of the response in the run-up to this, it suddenly became an emergency, but there was enough information for them to sort of dump their investments and act on their own, sort of like in their individual interests, but not enough to have a response at the policy level that would have, you know, I mean, potentially saved lives and not had to have had the emergency before all of these, you know, huge omnibus COVID response bills go through.
Yeah. Yeah. And just, I mean, I don't know how much they would have been allowed in the process had they stayed in DC, but they could have raised a fuss about the process on the House and Senate floor, because people were watching C-SPAN. You know, everyone was waiting for those stupid Trump press conferences every single day. I mean, I've had more people tell me that they've been watching C-SPAN since this started than since I've started the show. Mm-hmm. So if someone were to just stay there and get up on the House and Senate floor and just be like, this process is terrible, and explain it to the American people, that could have served a purpose. Mm-hmm. If someone could have gotten their hands on the text that they were considering putting in there and highlighting some of this stuff, that could have served a purpose. Mm-hmm. There's things you can do even if you're locked out of the, you know, the closed doors. Now, and those opportunities were just squandered by so many people.
Now, having listened to your show for so long and having paid attention to the way that their sort of government has operated for the past, at least for the past, you know, 10 years or so, but definitely, or at least probably for longer than that, I'll put it that way. There is a lot of, this is not the only time in the history of the United States government that there has been, oh, wow, it's a crisis. We have to do something right now. So we're going to create this giant, you know, 2000 page, whatever bill and pass it without anybody getting a chance to look at it. That seems to be something that has happened
every year, over and over again.
Yeah. Over and over again. And that's sort of the mechanism by which the sort of government operates.
It's the government shutdown strategy,
yeah,
is what we're seeing. So they constantly at the end of the year threaten us with a government shutdown. And then they pass these giant bills into law saying, if we don't have the president sign this, then, you know, the government's going to shut down. And so this is how they slip a lot of horrible things into law. It's the same exact strategy. This is just an actual emergency where the government funding crises are always of their own making. They're completely unnecessary. This is real. So that's the only reason that this is different. But yeah, they do this all the time. Every time you hear government shutdown, this is the strategy that's being employed.
So again, essentially, like, and when, so that's a method by which there can be these sort of like huge giveaways to, you know, the fossil fuel industries, for example, or in this case, in this COVID-19 case, pharmaceutical, or, you know, whoever makes the test or the vaccines or whatever. And that's, I think it's really important to sort of highlight that very specific point, that this is like, you could even look at it as saying like the government shutdowns were practice for this. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, one of the things that sticks out in my mind where this was used, and you being in Louisiana, I think your audience in particular might care about this. There was a treaty with Mexico that was crafted after the Deepwater Horizon spill to allow drilling in the Gulf even deeper than where the Deepwater Horizon was. And obviously, that wouldn't have been popular after the spill. Even calling it a spill sounds ridiculous because that was far more than a spill. But after the gusher.
It sounds like an accident.
Hillary Clinton in particular negotiated, when she was Secretary of State, negotiated this treaty. And they didn't want it coming up for a vote in the Senate on its own. So what they did was, during one of those government funding crises, they attached the treaty to government funding, and how it got passed into law. And so now they're legally allowed to drill even deeper in the Gulf than they did back then.
Which is
the exact opposite of what the public was asking for.
Yeah, and nobody, and again, that's not what's on the headline. So if you're not, if you're not seeing this in the news, this can probably sort of transition the conversation a bit. But if you're not seeing something like that in the news, you don't know about it. Because people are working their daily lives and they don't always have, you know, the opportunity to really dig into this kind of stuff. But there are, media that does cover this. It's just not a part of this sort of mainstream apparatus. And I was talking about this with Professor Harvey Kay, who's professor of Democratic Studies at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. And we had a really great conversation about what should a new media look like, and it has to sort of, it cannot be explicitly, I don't think, an independent media, sort of because of the way kind of culture works. Countercultures are sort of mitigatable. Does that make sense? They're able to sort of be pointed as something that's outside of where people are at. But I think that there has to be some kind of a combination strategy when it comes towards that. I don't know. But maybe I'm rambling here.
Oh, it's just, I've thought about the media a lot just because I'm trying to live what I want to see done. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the standards that needs to come back is that people need to provide their sources.
Yeah.
I mean, even on the highest of levels, how many times where it's an unnamed source saying a thing and it's just hearsay all over the place? Mm-hmm. I think people should have to provide their sources, and I make sure to do that. I also think that incorrect statements need to be apologized for if they're not caught in real time. And then when it happens in real time, there should be a standby fact checker. I mean, if Joe Rogan can do it, pretty sure CNN can pull it off. You know, you shouldn't be able to be a guest and say whatever the hell you want to say.
Right.
And I've actually been on TV before and no one has fact checked what I say. Uh-huh. They put the microphone on me and I can spout whatever I want. And it makes me very uncomfortable to know that's how this works. They just have one guest after another. You say whatever you want, and they've wrapped up their show. It's entertainment for them.
Yeah.
And that needs to change. And I think a lot of that has to do with the media being owned now by just six companies. The vast majority of our media is owned by just six companies. And so mm-hmm. these overlords have so much control over what gets reported and what doesn't. Work like mine is not what they want, because I'm pissing off everybody with money.
How are you going to make money doing that? You know,
well, I'm doing pretty well because I am depending on my listeners. Mm-hmm. And so I've gotten at this point dozens of really appealing advertising opportunities, mm-hmm. but I've turned them all down because I just decided I want to be accountable only to my listeners. And so it's at first when I did that and I was taking donations only, it was because my show was too small and that was my only choice. But now that I'm no longer in that case, I'm even more devoted to it because I get fired every day. Mm-hmm. Like every day someone's mad at me for something and then just like pulls their funding, but then I get hired by one or two more people. And so it all evens out. And so it's like, to do journalism like this, to be accountable just to the listeners, it gives me the freedom to say what I think is the truth, to earn people's trust by providing my sources, apologizing every time I'm wrong, mm-hmm. correcting it when I find it out. I mean, there's ways for this to be done. And what I feel like I'm most proud of is that I'm proving that you can do it without kissing the corporate ring, mm-hmm. and you can do it from your own kitchen table now, mm-hmm. with the way the internet is structured. And so, and if I gave a damn about promoting my show, it would probably be bigger than it is, but I'm too busy reading laws. But yeah, so I do think there is a path forward with this, and you're seeing it in bigger forms of media. So like Intercept, The Intercept is a phenomenal resource. And they're doing their funding the exact same way. It's 100% listener supported. There's no ads on their website or on their podcasts. And they're some of the best journalists that there are. Matt Taibbi apparently just left Rolling Stone. He's going to be doing his own thing.
Okay.
I think so. I didn't see that tweet from Matt, but Matt retweeted it. So I'm feeling like that. Why would he do that if it wasn't true? But might not be true. Just putting that out there. Okay. But he's thought about doing that for a long time. So there's a lot of people that I really respect that are leaving their overlords and trusting the audience to support their work. And it's merit-based. Like if I were to go and just make something up, my audience would punish me. They would go away.
Yeah.
And so you do have to keep your standards high and develop trust and maintain that trust to make this funding model work, where trust doesn't matter if what you do is what CNN does. All that matters is getting eyeballs on the screen for CNN and keeping those eyeballs through the commercial breaks. That's all they care about. That's how they make their money. And that's a completely different way of doing things. I might have to give people uncomfortable information, which I do all the time. CNN either wants to scare the shit out of you or tell you something that you really want to hear so that you stay on the screen. Yeah. They love the fights between Democrats and Republicans or left and right. Like they love it because it gets people's emotions all up and they want to see the second half of that fight. So they stay there through the commercial break.
There was a great example of that. Like it was the day that Bernie Sanders dropped out and John King, like, so there was a clip probably played about like 3 minutes prior where they have the clip of Bernie Sanders when he was doing his sort of like farewell thing or whatever. And he said like, I plan on working with Joe Biden, who's a person I trust. And then John King, like literally 3 minutes later, is like, well, Bernie Sanders didn't have anything nice to say about Joe Biden. You're like one of those sorts of things. And you're just like stirring up drama, you know?
Yeah.
Just being messy.
It's insufferable. I can't watch it for more than like 10 or 20 minutes because it just makes me so angry with the resources they have, the amount of information that they could share with us and how good the news could be. I mean, I'm a news junkie. I would love to just hear the news. And it's just, it's all squandered. And I think the ownership and the advertising model is a big part of that. So the more and more people we respect that get the balls to go out on their own and prove that they can be successful, the more people will do that and the more journalism will change. And I'm seeing that happen. I'm participating in that happen, but I'm seeing that happen to people that I look up to. And that is one of the things that gives me more hope than just about anything happening right now.
I think you're right about that. I think that things are developing. However, I think a lot of these sort of new, and maybe I'm wrong about this, a lot of these sort of like new media operations kind of stand on their own. And there's not a whole lot of, there's not really a strong sort of uniting connective tissue amongst them. There's sort of like an ecosystem of, oh, you go on that show, you go on this show or whatever. There are a couple of, I suppose networks like the Young Turks or something that have a little bit tighter of a network and they have a bit more resources collectively, even though I have issues with their practices when it comes to their labor relations right now. But I guess one of the things that I think potentially could be a next step for this new media thing is like a lot more closely working together amongst these sort of new media operations, I suppose.
See, I don't feel like it's all that necessary to be connected like that. I mean, I've been on the Young Turks, I don't even know how many times now. It's been a few. And I have an open invitation to go back anytime I want. And I just don't feel like it's all that necessary for me because we do very different things. I mean, the Young Turks, they do punditry. So when I show up there, the way that it works is that they give me, like I usually show up around noon and they give me a stack of articles for me to read that we're going to comment on. And then we go on television and we comment on them. They do have some investigative journalism going on, But I kept going on their shows expecting, like, because every time I did it, I was like, let me just feed you this one story. Like, can we talk about this one thing? And they never bit.
That's not
you
the
know,
point.
And it's, yeah. So they want to do commentary. That's not really my game, you know? Mm-hmm. And like The Intercept, they want to do investigative journalism and they should do that. And so there's a lot of podcasters that just want to do commentary and I don't see that much use in mm-hmm. combining those missions. So it's like, I really like that a lot of us in independent media are being, we're doing different things and we're mm-hmm. serving our own roles. And like, I love the independence of it because then you do get some group think. Like when it mm-hmm. comes to the Young Turks, the one thing I don't really 100% agree with them on is this idea that college should be free like high school. Mm-hmm. I have issues with that. And I don't really want to
get into it.
But it's like, it's one of those things where it's like, I don't fit perfectly in their ideological bubble, but if I were to go on their show every single week, mm-hmm. I would feel the pressure to be more in the bubble. Sure. So while I like dipping in and out and being a guest, and like I really have enjoyed every single mm-hmm. interaction I've had with them, I don't want to be in their network. I don't want to be connected like that because I really want to maintain my ability to look at an issue for what it is and not try and fit it into some bubble, whether it's on purpose or on accident.
So that's the thing, I think, the on accident part. But I guess what I mean here, to clarify, is not necessarily that like we would all become a part of one sort of network, but there would be more of a somewhat tighter but broader ecosystem of these kinds of new media operations that would be that would help one another out. And the way that I sort of see things, at least down here, and like a lot of these a lot of new media operations, though not all, operate on the coasts, and it maybe I'm wrong on that too, but that's sort of like just the way I sort of see it. I don't see coordination at a level that I think is necessary to kind of provide a coherent, strong alternative. Does that make sense?
Sort of. I think once you just have more people doing this and being successful, mm-hmm. then it's going to just be more, it'll be more enticing mm-hmm. for young journalists to want to do it this way. Mm-hmm. Because right now, the dream and the millions come to people that make it on the television somehow.
Yeah, they sell out, yeah.
And so that's becoming more and more of a shameful endeavor. But the people that do make it on the television, they are the ones that are paid the most handsomely. But I mean, you see Chapo Trap House, if you've checked out their Patreon lately, like they're making something crazy. Something like, what was it, like $92,000 an episode or something nuts, like, or that much money a month. And so the more and more situations you have, and like right now they are few and far between, but I think the more of those examples that you can come up with off the top of your head, that idea that independent media can swallow the corporate influence, mm-hmm. that's how it's going to happen. We are so far off from that, mm-hmm. which I think you and I agree on that.
Definitely.
But I don't see how we would coordinate more and uh-huh. like what that would look like.
Right.
And maybe without that's just, us dissolve or devolving into groupthink.
Right. Maybe that's just my organizer brain. Like part of what I do with my union and also with I'm a member of the Democratic Socialist of America is sort of like find people and find ways to kind of organize and get them to work together. So maybe that's just my brain thinking about trying to do the same thing, you know what I mean?
Yeah. But I think organizing and independence are kind of the opposite.
Yes, and I think like part of that independence is that is almost like an alternative to the status quo power structure, right? And maybe mm-hmm. I'm getting a bit abstract here, but there is a way, and it would happen on the terms of the people that would be doing that organizing, that would they would sort of like organize on the terms by which they agree to, and then sort of like aim their collective power at the at the sort of status quo apparatuses that they want to destroy.
Yeah. See, the way I see it is like, I think the organizing is needed to change stuff in politics. You need to organize around candidates. You need to organize around bills and legislation. Like, that's what organizing is need. The way I see it is that journalism, what we produce are the tools for the organizers. So I feel like the journalists need to be independent so that we can look at things clearly without any of the groupthink going on. And then you can use this article from The Intercept to help make your point. You can use this episode of Congressional Dish to help make your point. But you need your journalists to be looking for the truth no matter where that takes us. And sometimes it's going to take us places that don't fit with the mission that the organizers are going for. But that truth still needs to be out there. If the journalists were in there with the organizers, they might try and twist what they're saying to fit the organizers' mission. And that's where we get in trouble. That's exactly what's happening in corporate media. Like Bernie Biden. They're subtly twisting things to make Biden look better than Bernie. You know, it's like because they are incentivized to get the corporate candidate and not the Bernie Sanders, who's like, I'm going to burn you all down. So that's where the danger lies with having journalists and organizers be on the same team. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. I do. And I also, so one of the things that I've noticed in organizing spaces is that they are getting a much more developed and articulated communication strategy, which is also important. I mean, that, but they're going to be players in this new media space for that. So I'll give an example. The Chicago Teachers Union, especially during their strike that they had this past year in October, which I was able to go to, by the way, which was awesome.
Nice.
They started a podcast and they had like big banner announcements for their members on their website and also for press and for whatever to go get it. And that sort of messaging strategy is something that I think organizationally is necessary. And that might be more about what I'm talking about, but that sort of like organizational messaging strategy is necessary. And I think perhaps, and that's kind of what we do here. And I'm not, I'm definitely not saying you're wrong. But I think that's part of that ecosystem, I suppose.
Yeah. I don't really know. Cause I'm just not in the
organizing.
That's not
your space. That's not your space. That's fine.
Well, I mean, I'm that person that my quarantine has been completely the same because I'm always by myself in my apartment. And like, so I'm a loner in this. And maybe that's one of the reasons why I'm just like, I don't want to organize. I don't want human contact. Like maybe that's just like a part of me. But I also like, I really do believe that for me, I can't give advice on how to best organize because I have spent my career being like, okay, I have an opportunity to be in the Young Turks, but like, no, I'm not going to take it. And like, I have an opportunity to be in this structure of advertising, which has worked for decades. No, I'm not going to take it. Like, I'm pushing all of this away to be as independent as possible. So we're just, our missions are so different that I don't think I can give any good advice.
And I'm not asking for advice, but I was just sort of like bouncing the idea off and just sort of seeing what you think. And I really appreciate the feedback that I'm getting from you on this. I really like, I don't know, I respect the perspective that you're articulating right now.
Well, thank you. From this loner. Yeah. From this loser over here.
I would never say that.
Oh, I know.
Well, anyway, we're coming up on time, unfortunately. I wish we could talk longer, but I have another appointment.
Well, we can talk again.
Absolutely. And you're always welcome to come on GMC. Where can we find information on your program and how can we help support your show?
Well, Congressional Dish is available wherever podcasts are. I find that Spotify is probably the easiest for anyone to use on whatever kind of phone you have. And then the most important thing I do are the show notes, which you can find usually in your app. Those are all my sources, but also on congressionaldish.com. So give it a shot if you want to know what Congress is doing.
And Patreon.com is one of the ways that you raise money. You can also give them
however you want to give me money, I'll take it.
Yeah,
so I take checks and PayPal and Venmos and Patreons. I'll take whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. All those options are on congressionaldish.com and in every episode's show notes. Thanks for bringing that up.
Of course. And you can also listen to Good Morning Comrade on Tuesdays. We're also, so because of this COVID business, I've had more time to sort of like find and sit with people and talk with them for interviews. Thanks again for your time on this. You can listen to Good Morning Comrade on Tuesdays on WHIVFM.org/listen or on 102.3 FM in the New Orleans area. You can also check us out at goodmorningcomrade.com. Follow me on Twitter at Eminent Prof. Follow Jen on Twitter at Jen Briney, right?
Yep.
And anything else?
No, that should do it.
All right.
If you want to see pictures of my dog, you can also follow me on Instagram at Jen Briney.
Dogs are cute. Well, anyway, thanks so much, folks. Love you. Bye.